Henry Swanson, Session 3, February 9th, 1978.
See, the McCulloch was one of Admiral Dewey's ships in the Battle of Manila. Manning. I went down to Seattle on the Manning, 1910. Yeah, here's the Manning.
That same type of boat was...
Yeah, this was the McCulloch.
Same as the Manning.
Well, the Manning was smaller.
Oh.
But they were both, I think they were both in the Battle of Manila.
But there was a Manning, Coast Guard cutter Manning here.
Yeah.
They had a baseball team and that team at the road.
Well, that was new Manning, I guess.
Oh, it must have been new one.
Yeah. This Manning was, let's see, it was not much bigger than one of these biggest crab boats.
Hmm. There were several of them, because that then they looked big to me.
You know? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the Manning was much bigger than the new
one. Was that the old Manning?
No, I don't think so. Itasca?
Oh, well, there was, I think they built a new Manning.
Yeah, that must have been a new Manning.
See, all these were coal burners.
Yeah.
They all burned coal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one picture shows that black smoke coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, that's, well, the AC company, the dock down here was really Coast Guard dock.
Yes.
You know, Coast Guard, that was full of Coast Guard all the time.
Yeah, I've seen that, a picture of the dock when it had all kinds of, they had those small ones with the Greek names, Ariadne and...
Mm-hmm.
Where did we leave off?
Well, we were going to, we got up far as herring fisheries. That would be around 1930,
okay.
1928. And let's see, yeah, we mentioned it just before we quit. See, the herring appeared here in, I think, 28. Because nobody fished them, they came unexpected from nowhere, and very heavy, and they didn't expect them. 1929, though, there's a few local fishermen packed herring.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 30, the big outfits came, the big ones with the big purse seiners. And I think they packed, so a herd, 42,000 barrels. That's the barrels, you know, the big barrels that high that year. And also tons and tons of bloaters. That's the whole herring, you know, without taking the guts out. See, the gibbed herring, they... Well, they took the gills and the gut out with a little knife.
What's a tierce? I mean, my mom used to talk about tierces.
Oh, well, that's the big...
That was for the bloaters?
No, the bloaters, they did that in tanks.
Oh.
They had big canvas tanks, big as this room. And they built a frame and just shoveled the herring and salt in there. They made the bloaters. That's the whole herring. Without cleaning them.
Hmm.
I think they smoked them or something later on. Anyhow, they, yeah, the herring were so thick here, and they were big. They didn't pack any small herring. They packed extra large, large, and large, that's all. And there was no small ones. They were large and extra large.
Would they measure about 15 to 18 inches?
Well, they were, yeah, they were as big as a small, the extra large were big as a small humpy.
Hmm.
Or just about, or that is a real small humpy, which is a big herring.
Right, yes.
That's a big herring.
Hmm. What were the tierces?
Tierces.
Oh, tierces, they were just a big barrel.
Oh, just another size of a barrel.
Yeah, like there is a tierce about that big round, holds four barrels.
About this high.
Yeah. It's four barrels.
I see.
Is a tierce.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had the extra big barrel that they called the half tierce, which held two barrels.
Mm-hmm.
And the herring were so thick that they, well, they plugged up the channel down to dock there. That channel is 7 fathoms deep.
Yeah.
And then across, they plugged it. They were coming, they came in from Priest Rock this way and went through that channel, but they were coming faster than they could go through the channel.
Yeah.
So that channel would be plugged, solid herring from the bottom to the top, and sticking out the water that much.
Mm.
Yeah, they like a dam across there. Well, I suppose the herring that already were in there, they couldn't go any faster than the ones ahead of them. But here was 50 miles of herring behind them going in. I suppose they wedged in,
mm-hmm.
you know, they got pushed in between the other herring and,
yeah.
and they stuck out the water a foot, clean across the channel there, this end of the dock.
Yeah.
Here was herring falling off the top of this pile. So they were solid right from top to bottom.
Didn't they use the, what, you know, those big skiffs down there, those seine skiffs, they called them. I mean, they call them nowadays.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing huge skiffs coming in with only about that much freeboard.
Yeah, that's what they used for.
They were packed with herring.
For herring.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had big skiffs.
Mm-hmm.
And they, after the first year, they, the big outfits purseined them. They had the big purseine boats here.
Where did they go to fish?
Anywhere.
Yeah.
You didn't have to hunt. The herring were everywhere.
Hmm.
All they did was go out in the middle of the bay and drop their net, and that was it. And then there was some that seined them, the smaller outfits that used the seine.
Mm-hmm.
And seine, in the morning they'd stick their seine out right where they're packing their herring and pull the seine ashore and then pack without the seine all day. In the evening they'd open the seine, let what's left go. Then next morning they made a new haul right in the same place. They didn't have to go with a skiff and hunt for herring. They were there right in front of the saltery. And then I think on the, of course the big outfits quit the first, I think they only operated 2 seasons. And they couldn't make any profit, I suppose, and so they quit. But the smaller outfits, and of course they weren't too small either, they put up 2,000-3,000 barrels, you know, each. And they kept on going, but they had to be quite tight, you know, to make a profit, because herring brought $12 a barrel in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you bought your barrel and salt and all this and that and paid the freight to Seattle, you was $10 into that.
Wow.
So that left you $2. And if some little thing happened, little accident, you made nothing. Mm. See, the herring, the price of herring, well, herring from Iceland, Scotland, Norway, and you know, in the Atlantic side, they were putting them in Seattle for $12 a barrel, so that was the price. Well, those fellas over there made money at $12 a barrel because, well, their expenses weren't as big as up here. So that's the thing that that controlled the price. Well, anyhow, for about 5 years, I guess they were that heavy, the herring. Then they kind of, you know, slackened off a little. But there was still lots of herring, right up till the war. And then during the war, nobody fished herring.
Did this have quite an impact on the town, that fox farming was going downhill, and then this came in to fill the gap?
Oh, yeah, sure. And there was good money to be made on gibbing herring. Mm-hmm. See, they started in, they paid 75 cents a barrel. And then it went to $1 a barrel, and then later on it went $1.25, I think, a barrel. Mm-hmm. And a good gibber, a good packer, could pack 30 barrels. And, you know, a beginner could do, say, 15 barrels.
Was so, there any...
So at $1 a barrel, that was in 1930, that was a lot of money to mm-hmm. be made in one day. Mm-hmm. Like the good ones, they made $30 a day.
Yeah.
That was a fortune in 1930.
Yeah.
And it's nice even today. Yeah,
sure. There
but
was
then,
no,
There
was no machinery. I mean, this.
No, this was all hand.
And there were two people, one person gibbing and the other packing.
Yeah, in some cases there was.
Uh-huh.
And but there was some of them expert gibbers. There was a lot of Scotch girls. I don't know where they got them. Were here with the big outfits. Well, they were experts, that was their trade. Well, they didn't have no packer. They could give their own herring and pack and do 35. There was one girl over there that, Campbell, they were a small packer. There was old lady Campbell and her daughter, Nettie Campbell. And that Nettie Campbell could do 35 barrels a day. Yeah.
Did you have to be stooped over to pack into those barrels?
Well, some. Not too much, though, because them barrels were high, you know, and
yeah.
And they, I think they usually had them up on a little stand. Then there was a guy there that, when you got a barrel full, he rolled them away,
mm-hmm.
took them away.
Most of these plants were located where, on Dutch Harbor?
There was this dock here and Dutch Harbor dock, and there was others that had their own little dock, you know, this little boat landing, and done it right on the beach.
You know, across from where Agnes Beach,
mm-hmm.
that way to where I can find it on here.
Right here.
Oh.
Can't
see it. Yeah, right there. There were signs of a dock and
oh,
a
yeah.
house. You know, right? You look.
Yeah, I know. Old Port Grat Island.
Yeah.
In the, just before you get to Grat Island,
right.
That cove there.
The top of South
yeah.
America.
Yeah,
was
there was. There was a fellow by the name of Carlson. Built that. He was a Bristol Bay fisherman. He built that little dock there. He was going to fish herring, codfish, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he built a two-story saltery on the inner end of the dock.
Mm-hmm.
That is, he was going to salt fish down below and have living quarters up above. But he died at Bristol Bay. That place was never used.
It was never used, huh?
No.
Then, did anything happen in Margaret's Bay? Or over there where the float is now? Was there a herring saltries there?
No, not in Margaret Bay.
Or by...
They were all everywhere else.
I see.
They were, dock down here had half a dozen saltries on it.
And across the creek there was one too, wasn't it?
Well, that Vern Robinson, that was after the war.
Oh, that's the only time that was a saltery.
Yeah.
I see. I thought that.
The war, there was Jim Manson,
uh-huh.
and Vern Robinson. That was in 45. They were going to put up herring, but they got some, 400 barrels, I think. See, they had disappeared, but there was still some. Carl Muller, old man Muller, he packed two across the creek.
Oh.
But not just above Vern. He had the most herring. And I think maybe all three of them put up maybe 500 or 600 barrels. I think Carl Muller put up 400. He put up more than they did.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a strike on in Seattle, longshoreman strike, and they wouldn't unload this herring down there. It all spoiled.
Oh.
So those few hundred barrels these guys got, they lost them all.
Mm.
Especially Carl Muller, you know, that was, he was getting old and he decided he wouldn't go to Bristol Bay that year. So he fished herring instead, and he would have done good, because I think he got 400 barrels, and he done most of the work himself. Of course, Carl Muller, the boy,
uh-huh.
He had to work like mad, and the old lady worked.
Sure, yes, she worked in the other place too, didn't
and,
she?
And Agnes Shagan uh-huh. helped Carl Muller that year.
Right.
Oh, before the war, when they were all, everybody here that wanted to work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
See, Agnes Shagan and her husband, Joe Shagan, they worked together. They made about $20 a day.
I think my mother worked at Gibbing for a
while. Oh, yeah, sure. Everybody here
Bill
did.
Bill Blackenhoff and his wife.
Yeah, everybody here worked,
yes.
Especially for the local outfits.
I don't know who has it. You know, but somebody had a film of part of that.
Mm-hmm.
That I saw black and white. 8mm. It must have been 8 or 16.
See, there was three floaters came up too. At first,
mm-hmm.
You know, there was Don Lane. That was quite a big boat. That, of course, they packed on the dock, but they had the boat tied up the dock at Dutch. See, the Dutch Harbor Dock, you know, of course it's new now, but that's the same kind of a dock, same size as it was from 100 years back. It's been renewed a couple times, but it's the same dock.
Mm-hmm.
See, the first time they renewed that dock, 1930, they just built the approach. They're still using the old dock. They built the approach to one side, right and then built the tee out a little further, then tore the old dock out.
Did we get any new citizens because of the herring industry, Henry? Did some of those people stay in Unalaska?
Oh yeah, there was a few. There was Rod, for instance.
Oh, that's when he stayed.
Yeah, he came up to fish herring, then he got married here to that Alice. Well, she was married a couple of times before.
Did the, well, the trapping, fox trapping, they brought new people. And some of the people you mentioned before.
Oh, yeah, during the blue fox period, there was quite a few new people came in. Of course, they left afterward, too. Eve Bowman used to bring up quite a bunch.
Did that, the sheep on the Mackinac, were they, was that a sheep ranch? Did they shear those sheep and sell the wool? Or
on where?
On Dutch Harbor.
Oh, those were, yeah, Queen had them, Old Man Queen, but the sheep outfit, Nikolsky or one of them down there, they brought those sheep here and put them on Dutch Harbor temporarily.
Oh, I see.
And then they never moved them. Finally, Old Man Queen bought them. Guy had the store here. And he sheared them. There was 200 or 300 sheep.
People could go fox trapping and stuff from these other villages around here. Did the people move into Unalaska to work in the herring? Did that bring people in?
Not too many. Okay. There was some came in. See, at that time, well, they were content. They were, you know, they made a living with fur and so forth. And it was not a fancy living, but they lived off the country, mostly. So they were content, you know, and didn't go around looking to make big money. Because they had, well, the way they were living, they had enough.
Was that herring, was that seasonal, wasn't it?
It lasted all summer.
All summer?
Yeah, it was a terrific run and it lasted. They started in the spring and they were here all summer. It was a long season. And I don't know where they went. They were full of spawn too, these herring. I don't know where they spawned or where they came from. See, when they give the herring, they just took the gills and the gut out. They left the spawn in there. That was salted with the rest of the herring. Then the of course when they made the bloaters, of course the herring. Let's see. Oh yeah, when the red tide came, we used to have a lot of big red tides, and the herring would. This red tide, that was some kind of what they call them,
algae?
No, the sea, this little life that the fish eat.
Plankton?
Plankton, yeah. But it was red and it was supposed to be poisonous. But I guess the herring ate it. And well, anyhow, there was these bloaters. This herring would get their stomach, you know, when you ordinarily give the herring, you couldn't see no stomach. But when that red tide come around, here was a stomach about big as my thumb, full of food. Well, that stuff, that would rot, you know, when they...
I see, yeah.
When they assaulted them whole, you know. and then the stomach would explode, you know, blow the whole front of the herring out. And of course that herring was no good then.
Yeah, I did some research on red tide on something else that I was working on, and it's interesting Henry should bring it up, because I didn't know that they had red tides at that time. But from what I read, the authorities say that red tides happen because a form of life in the sea has a population explosion.
Yeah, that's what it is.
And then
that's
some of them,
plankton.
Yes.
It's a certain plankton that's red.
And some of that life would cause the existing things like mussels or darkies or sea eggs, while it wouldn't affect them, wouldn't kill them.
No.
If you ate those, you could get killed. And this is what happened to the others that went down with the Russians, because they weren't familiar with the red tide.
Mm-hmm.
But there were, because you say that the herring lived after they ate this, so it didn't kill a herring.
No.
But it caused them.
Well, I don't know if the herring ate it, but then at that time, when they had the red tide, and they had big ones, it wasn't just patches. The whole bay and even the ocean outside would be red. They had terrific red tides here then.
See, my first experience with them was in Southeastern. And then later, like, how long ago was that last one we had up here? It was very bad looking. I think it was in the summertime. And I think it was last summer there was a red tide.
Yeah, we had some.
And it not very good to look at, because we were up in the hill, kind of, and looking down at it, the extent of it, very not very good to look at. But
were herring, this big herring, was it found elsewhere in Alaska during this time, do you know?
No. No, it was just here.
How about Kashigo or Makushin today?
Well, yeah, I took herring fishermen with my boat down to these other bays, and there was some herring in there, but the big run was in here in Alaska. There was some in all the, you know, but here they were coming here by the billions. Well, I tell you, I went from here to Makushin, which, on the map here, it would be, I went out to Alaska here, and here was solid herring all the way to Makushin, because I went into Makushin, and here, here's Volcano Bay, that's a village, and there was herring in there too, but then not like here. And the herring were all traveling this way, coming here.
Traveling into Alaska.
Yeah. All the herring that, you know, how they flip this way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Were doing it this way.
Oh.
There was none going the other way. And that was solid mass of herring all the way.
Man.
That was a lot of herring. And they were that way day after day. You know, it wasn't just one day. And then I suppose they came over here, and they'd come in here, and all this big mass of herring tried to come through that little channel there.
Boy, that looks little now.
Yeah.
On the map.
But here is where they caught most of the herring. Over here too, but you know, here's where they were heavy, thick.
Along Summers Bay.
Right in here. Yeah, right. Straight out from the bay here. They didn't have to go anywhere else. The herring came to them.
How about, do you know anything about, you know, like Akatan or Sand Points and that?
Did they have
herring too?
Yeah, they had some, but not like here. They were all over.
Wow.
Those big herring, but they were real heavier just in Alaska Bay. Yeah, they caught them down around King Cove and all over down there, but they weren't like here. Here's where the big run was, and where they come from, and where they were going to, the herring themselves didn't know, I guess. Because they must have been looking for a place to spawn, because, gee, they were full of spawn, and they were fat, and there's no spawning ground for them here, that I know of. Anyhow, they got, after about 3 years of heavy, you know, there was still lots of herring, but they slacked off. After about, say, the sixth year, say 35 or so, somewhere in there, then, you know, you had to go and kind of hunt them, uh-huh. You know. They were still plentiful, but you couldn't just fish right here, any old place. You had to go and see where they were. But there was still plenty right up till the war, but they were getting a little less and less each year. Then after the war, like I say, there was none. Well, there was a few hundred barrels in 45, and 46 there was none.
How did they get all the herring back down to Seattle then? They must have had extra ships come in.
There was Alaska Steam and so forth that hauled them down.
Did they have a regular, I mean, like, you know, now we think of the Western Pioneer or somebody coming every month?
No.
Did they come on a regular basis?
No, Alaska Steam ran pretty regular.
Uh-huh.
See, they had... maybe a little. They had two trips a month to Nome, you know.
Okay.
All during the summer. Uh-huh. Well, they took herring. And then there was freighters and so forth. That all Alaska Steam. And they stopped here a lot. And they'd haul the herring to Seattle.
They'd haul passengers and freight, I take it.
Yeah. Well, there was some that were just strictly freighters. Then there was others that were freight and passengers. Then there was, well, all the passenger boats carried some freight too. But there was pretty good transportation then. Like if you wanted to go to Seattle, you could jump on the Nome boat twice a month.
Twice a month, that's good.
Oh yeah, that's up till the froze up there. Mm. And you got Seattle in 6 days. From here, the Nome boats, the passenger boats, were non-stop. Went from Seattle to here and Nome, and same way back.
Now, you mentioned yesterday or day before, I'm not sure when, that it was sometime before the war that you were starting a fox.
Oh yeah,
Fox
in,
camp out at
Morris Cove.
Morris Cove.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to do that?
Well, I don't know. I thought that it'd be nice to have a fox ranch with pens, mm-hmm. instead of going out an island somewhere. So anyhow, it was kind of a mistake, or the price went way down to nothing. I'd done good. First year on this.
When was the first year on that?
It was 39, I think.
39.
Or 40. Anyhow, it was, what spoiled it was the war came on too. Hmm. And the price went down to nothing, mm-hmm. besides.
Where did you get your stock from?
From Samalga Island.
Samalga.
See, I had Samalga Island. I bought it from Goss, from Mrs. Goss, the widow, Goss's widow, and I restocked it with better foxes. And then that's where I got my livestock for the fox ranch here.
Oh.
And I spent about 2 years, you know, with Morris Cove thing, and I did all right. The first year I raised 40 pups.
Mm.
And, you know, that was going to be my livestock.
What did you use for feed, Henry?
Well, I bought commercial feed.
Oh.
And then there was a lot of salmon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Humpy Cove was lousy. That was really a salmon place. And then I had... there was a lot of halibut around.
Mm-hmm.
I had a piece of halibut gear out. I used to catch 300-400 pounds of halibut in one day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have too much halibut, and I'd, of course, they were building the Charber then.
Yeah.
And the Northwestern was, they were using that for a barracks. They had built all up on top, and they used it for electricity too. They had her on the beach there, sideways, right where the, right close between the dock and that powerhouse, that concrete powerhouse. They had her sideways on the beach there, then they filled in on the beach side so they could drive trucks right into her. They had a big hole in her side and door. And I used to take halibut there. And they'd, they wanted to pay me for it. They wanted the halibut, the nice fresh halibut. No, heck, give me meat or whatever you got. So they used to load my dory up with meat. I had meat for the foxes and meat for myself.
Did you have any other problems with raising the foxes? Like, say, a mink farmer has to keep, you know, things kind of quiet around the farm.
Oh, yeah.
You
know. Yeah, that was one of my troubles. See, the war started and there was a lot of noise. In fact, there was a big outpost started there.
Right at Morris Cove.
Morris Cove. That's the one that's still there up the valley,
mm-hmm.
up past the lake.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course they come there with a, it was a tent job at first, but then there was all that racket, and then there was Navy observation plane. I went up every day and circled right around right above Morris Cove till they ran out of gas, and they went down, gassed up, and went up there and done it again.
Mm.
And that spoiled quite a few of my several. I lost quite a few.
But they don't breed when they're disturbed like that, or.
Well, the mother fox, will kill her pups stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I managed to raise 40 pups just the same.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one real good fox I had. She had 8 pups and raised them all.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I was getting breeding stock for next year.
Mm-hmm.
See, I brought these foxes already bred.
Oh, okay.
See, I went late to the island, say, in April or somewhere. See, they breed in February, I think, February and March. But I went in April and caught these foxes, and they were already bred. So I didn't have to. Sometimes you catch a pair of live foxes and put them in the pen, they won't breed in captivity. But these were already bred. And then the pups would have been born in a pen, and that would have been my breeding stock for the next year. That's the way I was doing it.
Was Sanalga the island that you were stuck on? You told one time, I think, about the boat was supposed to pick you up.
Oh, no, that was on the Four Mountains.
Oh.
And that was in 1933, you said, huh? Same year the Omnak Native.
When the Omnak Native got wrecked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they got wrecked. Well, they were going to pick me up the next day, and they picked up the Nikolski trappers on Omnak Island. This end they were trapping red foxes. Then they were going to Nikolski. They had a bunch of supplies for the Nikolski store, and they got almost to Nikolski, right in the middle of Ingenuda Bay, and it got kind of headwind, so they went in there just to anchor for the night, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And during the night the wind shifted and blew a howling gale. It got rough in there, and they couldn't get their engine started. Had the old engine in that brand new boat, and anyhow they dragged ashore in the, if they had went ashore up in that cove where there was a beach they would have been all right, but they went to one side where there was no beach, just big boulders straight up, and there they went to pieces there. I saw the wreckage later on, and there was just the deck and the deck house left. The hull was completely gone.
Yes.
And but all the people were in the galley on deck. But that galley door, it had that deck house had one door only on one side, and that was down.
Yes.
They couldn't come out. And but the people that were out there was John Stankus and his wife. That was
Olga.
That was Larry Shidenkov's aunt.
Right.
Yeah. And she had the baby too.
Mm-hmm.
That was Larry's sister.
Yes.
But they were out up in the pilot house, and George Duskin and couple others, they were in the pilot house, and during the night they managed to get ashore.
Yeah.
And that is three of them.
A Finnegan.
There was Johnny Stanks, yeah, Finnegan Ermolov, and George Duskin.
Yeah.
That's it, I think.
Yeah.
And Johnny Stanks died, though.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but shortly after, and the wife and the baby got washed overboard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were going ashore too, but I guess you had to be quite active to get ashore, because that storm was still on, but the bow of the boat did come up a little, and they saw their chance to get off. But anyhow, the Stanka's wife and the baby got, they were walking to the bow from the pilot house, and the big wave came and they got washed overboard.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of them got ashore in the morning, but they were cold, miserable, and
mm-hmm.
just laid down and died.
Yeah, many of them got trapped in that boat too.
Huh?
Some of them got trapped inside of the boat.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't get out.
But anyhow, the priest. And I think there was one boy, 14-year-old boy, that got out in the morning. Maybe it was him, wrapped the priest up in the furs.
Mm-hmm.
See, they had a lot of furs aboard from the end of Omnak, red foxes. Wrapped him up on furs and put box oranges. They had a lot of groceries aboard, box oranges or something. And the priest laid there for several days,
mm-hmm.
till the, it took these George Duskin, and it took them two or three days to walk into Nikolski. You know, they had to go away at the Bering Sea side and walk down and
mm-hmm.
across. So then took the rescue party. It was about 6-7 days before anybody came there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by that time it was all over.
One of the
finnegan. And then the penguin was coming from Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
The penguin went there after it got to Alaska, but then that was, they couldn't do anything. It was all over with. And, oh yeah, this boy, they found his body. He walked about, I don't know, several miles.
Yeah, he headed for the village too.
Huh?
He headed for the village too.
Oh yeah, he was on the trail. He knew how to go there.
Yeah.
And he sat down to rest. And of course he was tired after, you know, those people that were in the boat in that galley, they were all night long up to their necks in water. You know, that alone was enough to kill them. But this boy walked quite a while, and then he had a stick. Well, he stuck his stick in the ground, put his cap on top of it, and ate the orange. He had a, and then laid down to rest and fell asleep, and that was it. That was a horrible wind that night, because I had to leave my shack on. I was on Ulac Island.
Mm-hmm.
That's the smallest four mountains, the one closest this way.
Mm-hmm.
I was trapping that island. Well, I owned that island. That was one of my
leased.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times, you know, you leased an island, you didn't think it was any good, but it was good for one catch maybe,
mm-hmm.
which that island was.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I had to leave my shack.
Mm-hmm.
Either I thought it was going to blow away or blow apart. I crawled on the beach on my hands and knees, and either side of the shack was bending in like an accordion. And, good thing when I built it, you know, I thought, you know, I figured there'd be quite a lot of wind, so I drove roots in the ground, you know, before I put the floor on.
Mm-hmm.
I went down the beach and got long pieces of long sticks, driftwood, and pounded them in the ground this way and that way and everything, then nailed them to the floor joists, you know, like roots.
Uh-huh.
And that worked. But the side, gee, that the two ends of the house were going in and out this way, so crawled on the beach. And,
that got was the night of that storm.
Yeah, that's when they were being wrecked over mm-hmm. there. And I didn't know it at the time. And I crawled, and I knew where there was a long sapling, you know, a small tree about that big around. And I drug that up the house and sawed it right length, and I put it right at the eaves, one end to the other of the house. It's a small 10 by 12,
uh-huh.
10 by 12 shack. And I put, you know, so that I fitted it tight there, so that, well, instead of the end blowing in, it was the ends trying to blow in, that the other end would help this end with that. And it worked. The house stood there. And I went, then I got me a couple blankets and a sandwich and tobacco and cigarette papers and matches. And down the beach there was a great big rock with a hollow underneath like a little cave. I went in there and sat in there all night. And my dory went to pieces that night. I had it chained to a rock, and I had it bottom up, and I had heavy wood piled on top of it, so the wind wouldn't get it. That wind took it and just waved it around the air.
Wow.
You know, it couldn't go anywhere. It was chained to this rock, so it just dashed back and forth, and just in the morning, all I had left my dory was a piece of bow stem that long with a chain on it. The rest of it was, well, it was just smashed to kindling wood.
You said you were stuck on an island. Most of those guys that went trapping, you know, had a dory with them.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have, like, emergency rations in the dory?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. About how much did it cost for you to pay for, like, your groceries for while you were trapping?
Well, I don't know. That's maybe $150.
Did the trappers buy that, or the people that trapped?
The owner of the island.
I see.
He paid $10 a pelt, and you know, expenses.
Yeah,
like the landing and groceries. See, the groceries didn't amount to much because, you know, most of the living people lived off the land.
Yes.
That's as far as meat went.
Right.
So the groceries mostly, you know, just...
Staples. Eating what? Seal and then ducks and stuff?
Oh, yeah, sure.
But not fox.
Well, my stepfather said that one year he and his partner ate fox, and according to what I read in, you know, from other people, you can eat fox, but it's got a, it's really very greasy and not that
be
good to taste.
Strong.
Yes. Well, I know one guy that he didn't have to eat the fox, but he ate it. That was old man Muller, Carl Muller's father.
Oh.
Yeah, he was, him and I think this was Carlson, the same guy that built that
dock,
yeah.
Okay.
They were trapping for old man Nye. Nye had this volcano island, the Gurloy.
Yeah.
And I guess Carlson got cabin fever or something. So Muller was staying home that day, and Carlson was going out. And so Muller asked Carlson, hey, what would you like to eat? They had a lot of food, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what would you like to eat this evening when you get back? Oh, he said, cook a fox. So Muller did. And of course, he doctored it up.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know what he did to it, but he said it was good. He ate two hind legs himself that evening, he told me, and but Carlson wouldn't eat the fox. He ate the potatoes, but he ate the gravy.
Yeah,
there was gravy made from fox, and he ate that, but he would not eat fox. Carl Muller asked him, what's the matter? Don't you like my cooking, my fox? And, yeah, it's good, but it's fox. Well, that's the same way I told a cook down Panama one time when we went on a little excursion.
Oh, yes.
A dozen of us.
Yeah.
And we went up some river, I don't know what river it was, in the jungle. And there was a lot of monkeys. Gee, there was monkeys, millions of monkeys everywhere. So one day he shot some monkeys and made monkey stew. And gee, I couldn't eat it. I tasted it. It was good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was real nice. Everybody ate it but me. I hick. Eat the monkey, you know. And so I opened a can of corned beef and ate that. The monkey stew was better than the corned beef, but it was monkey.
How long did you have to stay on Ulac?
Yeah, on the 4 months.
Yeah,
that time. Geez, a couple extra months.
Wow.
You know, and gee, I was, of course, I wasn't short of food. I always took plenty with me, you know. So, and I was by myself, though. That was bad.
Yeah.
You know, it was all right when I was trapping and working, but when I was waiting, being by yourself, that was kind of lonesome.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, there was just a couple of months extra, and then Snapper Larsen picked me up. He came from Seattle with a Dorothea, I think, Dorothea, yeah. And I didn't know what the heck happened. And every night I, you know, I thought, well, there's some boat coming close here. I had a barrel there, and I'd put pour some oil in this barrel and a couple of pieces of wood and light the, like a lighthouse in case the boat was coming, and so they wouldn't have to wait till morning. You know, if they were close there, I wanted them now. So anyhow, in the morning, one morning I got up, I looked out, heck, no boat, nice weather. So I made a pot of coffee and was drinking the coffee when I heard a whistle blow. See, the boat was already there, but was just around the point, out of sight. While I was drinking coffee, here they come. And of course, I had no dory. My dory was smashed up, and so they launched the dory, come ashore. As soon as I saw that boat there, I dumped the coffee pot and I had everything packed, ready to go. The steep bank there, I threw everything over the bank down there, and when the dory got ashore, I was ready. I was there. And the dory crew, well, ain't you want to get your stuff? Well, here, oh, it's all here. Let's go. Let's go.
All that during that time that you were either taking trappers out or trapping yourself or running your own boat.
Mm-hmm.
Were there other times when some of the guys got stuck on an island?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't exactly get stuck, but they were there longer than they expected.
So you went out after Paul Burton, didn't you?
No.
But you remember, he was the latest, or the last, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah.
Mm. The last what?
Trapper to go out that didn't come back.
Oh.
Yeah.
There were, I don't know altogether how many.
Oh, there was quite a few.
That went out and didn't come back.
Yeah.
Partners or
yeah. Well, alone. Paul Burton, see, he was going to trap Wenaska.
Where is that at?
That's Nick Peterson was trapping the next island. That's Amukta.
Oh.
Patterson had that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they couldn't land on Wenaska, so Paul Burton landed on Nick Peterson landed with a big skiff and his supplies. He had a big herring skiff with outboard motor. So he stayed with Nick, and then he started to go across to the other islands, 12 mile across that pass, and here a sudden gale of wind came up. So and he got caught in that. Nick Peterson found the skiff.
Oh.
He tried to get back to Amukta, I guess, and run ashore there. The skiff was there, all tore up on a rocky beach.
Yeah, I remember Paul. He came here to Alaska. I think he was...
He was married to...
Augusta.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I don't know the by
name. Yeah.
The
well,
girl's name.
Yeah.
Evelyn.
Evelyn, yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, he stayed here during the war.
And this was after the war that
Yeah. Oh. Yes.
Yeah, the He stayed here during the war, but his wife went with the rest of them.
Yes.
And then when they came back, his wife wouldn't go back to him for some reason or other. And they got divorced, and he got married again to another one. What was... She was from a cushion, I think.
Fanny?
Fanny was her name.
Yeah. I don't know what her... I don't recall what her maiden name was. It was Simeon Putnikoff's sister, I thought.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yes.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
She should have been Fanny Putnikoff.
Mm-hmm.
And... I remember that because I was here when Paul went out, and I remember that he didn't come back.
Yeah.
I remember the first time he got married too. There are a lot of stories that it would take some time for me to sort. I'm sure Henry knows a lot more, you know. Probably some of them firsthand about guys who went cabin crazy or rock happy or whatever. And
there were several of those happening on the island.
Boots.
Well, Boots.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they were on Sergi, they were there close to Kiska.
Yeah.
And, when they went there to pick them up, they were both dead in the house. They'd been dead quite a while, and they had the door nailed shut.
From the inside.
And they left a note there that that there was an outside man or something on the island. Anyhow, he shot the boy first. And then they shot himself right in the house.
Where were they from?
Atka. Yeah.
They called him Brother Boots, and his boy's name was Simeon.
Yeah.
Boy, before
Boots happened, was his nickname.
Yes.
Yeah.
Before this happened, the boy went to school in Alaska. And one of the things I remember about him was that he was left-handed and very independent and pretty tough, pretty tough guy. He was kind of small, but his dad was kind of a guy that everybody liked, and he had the nickname of Brother Boots, I suppose maybe because of hip boots. But
He was a nice guy. I didn't think he'd do anything like that, but that's what happened.
Yeah.
And then, let's see, Bowman's gang, though, there was a lot of that kind of stuff happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like on Canig Island, there was, I forget the guy's name. They were on the end of, right on the end of Canig. That's the island next to Adak.
Uh-huh.
And there were sea otters there.
Oh.
Nice sea otter place. There was sea otters here and there and everywhere in those days. You know, not lots, but then a few everywhere out along the islands. And there were three of them there. Well, when they went to pick them up in the spring, there was just this one guy left. Oh, he said these other guys, they went out to the dory and got dumped. And we questioned him, and he was lying. He said they had the sail up and they sailed out there, and which way was the wind? The wind was this way. You know, they would have to be sailing against the wind, which a dory can't do, you know.
Yeah.
Because the dory drifts sideways.
Yeah.
You know, got no keel on it, and it's flat. So, the dory was found further up, a couple of miles up the beach from there. So anyhow, then the next year, that guy was still there again the next year, but there was just one man with him. And when they come back to pick him up, then this guy that was there the first year, he was gone. Oh. And this other guy was there by himself. And he told a story about, you know, he killed this guy, I guess. Anyhow, I went to Seattle on the boat with him. That guy, as soon as we hit Seattle, he disappeared. Oh. He didn't even stop to get his money from Bowman. He disappeared. He was guilty, you know. And then the next year, I don't know if you remember the guy, he worked for Bowman, Johnson. Well, anyhow, Johnson was there by him and by himself mm-hmm. at this place, and he was going down the creek. You know, he was going to shoot some geese on the beach, and so he went inland there and went down this creek. And there had been a lot of rain, and this creek had flooded. And here he ran across a skeleton. The creek ran over the bank, you know, and washed away this. And it was this man. This man that had been there for 2 years. They identified him by his bridge work.
Wow.
You know, they took his false teeth. And they. So this guy killed him and buried him there. But it was on the bend of the creek. The creek went this way, you know.
Uh-huh.
And when it flooded, it ran over this little peninsula and washed the body out.
Uh-huh.
So that was one, two, three guys got murdered there at that one camp.
Yeah.
Bowman's camp. Then there was George Gurdjieff, or Grig, he was from that too. Him and another guy was at Bowman's main camp.
Mm-hmm.
On, well, when they came to pick them up, there was nothing there. The house was burnt.
Uh-huh.
And they found what they thought might be their bones in the house.
Huh.
But this guy had, one of them had been to the bug house, Morningside,
uh-huh.
the guy from that too. Grigory, or let's see, what the heck was his name, anyhow. Yeah, he had been to the bug house,
uh-huh.
so he might have got crazy again. They had turned him loose from the
uh-huh.
bug house. And
what island was this on?
On Bowman's Island,
Caniga.
Uh-huh. That's right next to Adak, right in the harbor there,
uh-huh.
where the main camp was. But they were there by themselves, the two of them. Let's see, who was the other guy?
Yeah, I used to. How much did you put into the stories about the outside man that the trappers would bring back?
Well, there was. Oh, yeah, there was another outside man thing. We went up to. This was John Gulladoff and Bill Diakonoff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll wait till he comes in, huh?
Yeah.
I think I'll smoke a cigarette, okay?
Sure, yeah, he says it's okay. I got, I was using my cup. I left coffee in it.
Oh. I should quit the smoking cigarettes, but...
picture of Canada. I was looking at just today in a Alaska magazine not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Dig it out.
There was a guy from ADAC wrote an article about Canada.
Okay. Mm-hmm. This was in something else, Lyle Morgan article, but it had in the color section there. It was like a sunset overlooking part of Canada. It had a volcano on one end kind of thing.
Yeah, Canada is a long, low island with a just the volcano on the north end, on the Bering Sea end.
Okay.
And I think 1,000-foot hill in the middle, which was not steep, but, you know, just gradual. It's a fine island for livestock. Very good island. And, I saw that volcano in eruption one time.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah. It was past it in the evening, and it was lava running out the top.
Yeah.
And it ran halfway down and went over a cliff, like a waterfall.
Oh, that would be something.
And then right down to the beach. Because by the time it reached the beach, that spread out sideways, because a big cloud of steam coming out of the sea, you know, where this hot stuff was hitting it.
Yeah.
And, when I went out to ADAC later on, after the war, the officers there asked me about that island. That's when I took the yacht out.
Mm.
What was the name of that guy going around the world, his family?
After the war. After the war?
Oh, quite a while after the war.
There was an Englishman that came through here, I remember, on a sailing boat.
No, this guy was from Sausalito, California.
Oh.
And he had an 85-foot yacht. He had his wife and daughter and son and two cousins, I guess, or whatever, two boys. That was the crew.
Man.
He had no hired crew. And they were all navigating, you know, and they were good too. And so anyhow, they got me. They wanted to stop on some of the islands between here and ADAC, but then after we got going, they decided not to. So I went right through to ADAC. And let's see here, his company was part of Sims Drake.
Oh.
Yeah, he told me that Sims Drake was a combination of several companies. You know, the job out here was too big for one company, so they combined and formed Sims Drake.
And it was
this guy's company was in Sims Drake.
Drake Puget Sound?
Well, it was after the war, it was Drake Puget Sound, but during the war, it was Sims Drake, and Drake Puget Sound was part of it. Of course, at the end of the war, they separated and had their own outfits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this guy, it was a California construction outfit. He said their share of Dutch Harbor was $35
million.
Yeah, wow. That's just his share. That is his... company share of Dutch Harbor was $35 million of the construction here. So, CG, I knew him real. I just can't think of his name. The yacht was named after a star.
Oh.
Anyhow, we went to ADAC. He wanted me to keep on going with him to Japan, which I should have, but I didn't.
I think I was up in St. Paul then.
Yeah, he stopped at St. Paul.
Yeah.
And he had quite a rough deal up there. You know, it's rough weather, and then he came from St. Paul here. Then he went from here to Japan, of course, stopped in ADEC.
Mm-hmm.
And well, we got in ADEC. I stayed up all night that night. He asked me, he said to take her into ADEC. And he had papers and everything to the commanding officer in ADEC, you know, to take care of him nicely and this and that, you know. And anyhow, I took him into ADEC in the morning and woke him up. And we tied up the dock in there, and commandant came down, got him to him and his wife and daughter to come up to you know, to his house and have breakfast with him. And while they were up there, here come the security officer. He was a Navy lieutenant. Yeah, he come down and looked the boat over. You know, nobody liked him there, and they didn't wake him up.
Oh,
and
tell him you'd come in?
That, yeah, he didn't even know we were coming in, I guess. So, what you fellas doing here? What boat is this? And who is the captain here? Well, one of the boys was there, and because I said, well, here, this guy, he's the boss now, and he's just a young kid. And I said, the captain, I said, is up with the commander having breakfast. He didn't have much to say after that. And yeah, he was mad because they didn't wake him up, tell him this strange boat was coming in. You know, he wanted to go down there and wave his hand around, be important.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was angry about, that's what he was mad about.
Yeah.
Because there was no trouble for him, you know. They wouldn't
while you were out of the room,
huh?
And we were still on the subject of fox trapping, we had been on to some of the times that some of the trappers didn't come back for different reasons, and I asked Henry how much stock he put into the stories about the outside man.
Yeah.
He started to, but then he said, we'll wait till Reagan.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well,
okay.
This John Gulladoff and Bill Diakonoff were trapping on an island at Cavalga. That's about 90 miles this side of Amchitka. And I was out there, we were picking them up, you know. And we were kind of late, and we couldn't land where the house was. It was early in the morning, so we landed on the other side of the island, and there was three of us walked across to the house, and they were still in bed, and we couldn't figure out what was wrong there. It was you know, we knocked on the door, there was no answer. We knew somebody was in there, it was locked. There was a couple of geese hanging up on a nail by the door, so fresh geese. And we couldn't look in the windows. They had the windows all blocked off from inside with blankets and gunny sacks, whatever they had. So finally they answered, who's there? Well, I said, it's Henry Swanson. Well, they knew me, and but they still wouldn't believe me. I said, well, go out there and stand in front of that window so we could look at you. So I did. I stood about 30 feet from the window. Stood at attention and looked at the window, and gee, they were so scared that they wouldn't open that blind. Mm. They took this way quick looks at me. Well, then they saw it was me and they let us in.
Ah.
And let's see, one of them was shaking so bad that he couldn't put his socks on. They were still in bed. Let's see, yeah, he sat there on his bed, you know, he missed his sock. And we asked him what was wrong. They said there was outside men on the island. They only had 30 foxes. See, that island usually produced 150 to 200 foxes. But they had just trapped around the house. They just killed foxes that came to the house. They hadn't been away from the house for all the time they were there. Because they got all they wanted to eat right in front of the house. There was a nice place there. Geese and ducks came in there, and there was seal rookery right there and all that. So how
did they figure there were outside men on the on that
well,
island?
Well, they saw something. And it scared them, so they just stayed home. They had their guns loaded, ready to shoot and stuff like that. So they, they told me later on that one time they almost shot one another.
Ah.
Yeah, when they were both out, you know, right around the house and happened to meet. But I don't know. That
there were a lot of stories, you know. We heard them when the people would come back. My stepfather was out, and a lot of the other guys were around. And then later, as I was growing up, talking with sons and daughters of other men that went off trapping. I've never seen an outside man, but I've heard a lot of stories about them. And one thing my stepfather did tell me, though, was when I asked him if he had any trouble with them, he said, no, you know, they're there. And then what they used to do for self-protection was to make sure there was some food, like they'd leave a duck hanging out on a nail or something, food of some kind. And he said that they didn't have any problems. He did tell me, and not only me, but my sisters and brothers, that you learned pretty fast you didn't have food out there. Pretty soon there would be, you know, at night when they're supposed to be sleeping or trying to sleep, things would be thrown at the house, rocks off the beach, driftwood, you know, and if there was any kind of gear left out, it would be scattered around, or things like that. And so they would make sure that there was some kind of a peace offering. And they said that they, because I was cynical, he said, you know, I really didn't believe these. I said, well, how could you tell that there were? He felt very strongly that there were outside men, and he told me about seeing tracks of them along the trap line from other people, and down through the years, you know, some people thought, well, maybe it's a shipwrecked sailor or a shipwrecked Japanese person, or, you know, some person that was there. But I don't know, there were so many, many stories about outside men and the trappers.
It goes back a long ways, too, because Inikinti Shaisnikov in the 1870s told Elliot when he was passing through here, I mean, he believed in them and said they were bands of unchristianized Aleuts who had run away from the Russian settlements. And lived up in the hills or
Well, that could have been in old days, but
oh, yes.
There wouldn't be any of them now, I don't think.
Well, you stop and think of them.
But, on my own island on Cavalga, mm-hmm. on Little Taniga,
mm-hmm.
I went to, there was quite a big snowstorm, and I went over through a pass in the mountain,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't go back there for a couple of months. And here was gigantic cracks. See, they were that. They were my own cracks. But you know, it was funny at first. You know, and they were perfect. You know, when the snow melted. They're smiling out there, listening to these lies. I guess.
No, they don't hear us. They're looking in.
Well, anyhow. They were that long,
mm-hmm.
in the deep snow. They
yes.
were perfect, you know. The mm-hmm. snow melted and cracks got big.
Mm.
Because I knew they were my own tracks.
Yeah, good.
And boy, I had Mike Creevden with me that time,
mm-hmm.
on the island. He's the one who shot Anchor Jacobson. In that.
Right. I saw him in later years.
Yeah.
I think he passed away in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
But
anyhow, there was about a mile from the camp, there was a nice beach, sand beach, with where we got wood. Well, we went over there, got a bunch of wood, and snowed. And here was, we walked in the sand. And then the snow covered their tracks. So a couple of months later, I was over there, and here was brand new tracks. It was my own tracks.
I see.
And gee whiz, they were new. I had brand new boots, and you know, little lumps on the bottom. Even those were still in them tracks. See, the sand froze, and then the snow went over. Then the snow came off, and here, 2 months later, so I went to see where these tracks came from. Heck, they came out the snow, and there was no tracks in the snow. So I followed them till they disappeared in the snow again. There were no tracks in the snow, so then I knew they were my own tracks.
There were enough accounts of the outside man, or a guy, a biologist on St. Paul Island, who was looking for real commercial fisheries are,
mm-hmm.
or the fish and game, whatever, to come to Unalaska and try to get stories firsthand from people. He was gathering all the stories that he could about the outside man, and the activities of the outside man haven't been confined to Rat Islands or Fox Islands. You know, many local people. I'm sure this is probably a subject that can be brought gotten into later. I just wondered if Henry had any, you know.
Yeah. Well, Andrew McCarron, in time, claimed that he met outside man up the valley here. You ever hear that story?
Yes.
The outside man gave him some money to get him tobacco. So he came downtown, he bought the tobacco and took it up and gave it to this outside man, that was it.
Hmm.
Now, he must have met the stranger up there, because this was, you know, this was true.
Yes.
You know, that is, he actually met somebody up there.
Yeah.
Maybe it was an outside man, but somebody he didn't know, some stranger. And he got this tobacco for this man and took it up there. Now, there was some man that didn't want to come into town.
Mm-hmm.
And could have been a prospector, some prospector that landed, you know, on the island, was prospecting and didn't want anybody to know he was here. Stuff like that. A Anyhow, this actually happened, and that is, Andrew, I don't think, was lying, because he told me that himself, about meeting this man right up the valley here. It was in the afternoon, and the man wanted tobacco and had money. He gave Andrew money, so Andrew came down here, bought tobacco, and took it up to him. So he said. And I don't think he was telling a story or anything, because Andrew wasn't, he didn't do those kind of things. Well, and then but one outside man, this was, let's see, in the 20s. Now, here was, well, they had codfish stations down in, around Chinoski. And the old Dora was the ship that this codfish company had, the old Dora. They were using her, and there was two men at this codfish station. It was in Station Bay, that's a little bay right next to Chinoski. And that's how it got its name, Station Bay. That's where the codfish station was. Well, they had one of Dora's lifeboats with an engine in. And they decided to come to Unalaska. So they took off, and the engine stopped on them. They couldn't get it started, so they drifted around Bering Sea. I don't know for how long, several days, I guess. Then they finally drifted ashore on Umnak, on this end of Umnak Island. And, maybe a month later or so, this guy showed up in the village on the other end of Umnak Island. Just one man. Yeah. And he told the story that they had a fight, and he killed this other, killed the other guy. So he was by himself. So they had a little house there in Umnak that was vacant. They let him stay in there. And Artie Ermoloff, you know him,
Yes.
told me that he went in there to see this guy one night, and this guy was mumbling to himself and burning money. Yeah, he had a whole bunch of money, and he was burning it in the stove. And the next morning he was gone. That's the last they ever saw of him. Because that time they didn't even know who he was. To them he was an outside man. But then later on when they, investigated, it was this fisherman.
I have another meeting.
You always have meetings.
Yeah. One of the meetings. Postponed from last night at noon to 4.
Oh, okay.
Father and Peter are supposed to be there.
Well, gee, we didn't do much today.
Well, we got quite a bit. Yeah. You know, one thing we need to do, too, is some of the things like the geography around the islands.
A little bit.
Like you mentioned this underwater volcano that you went over and things of that sort. That'll be interesting. And,
I ran over that thing when it was coming up. In 35, winter 35.
Winter 35.
Oh yeah, I brought this boat up from San Francisco. So I left San Francisco 29th of December, and came up here, and then I went out, picked up trappers, Attu trappers, on the way to Attu. So coming back, I didn't have to stop, so I come straight across, and when I was about passing Atka was probably 30 miles out. And 4 o'clock in the morning here, it was nice weather, fair wind. And I was running along, and here was all of a sudden that boat just I don't know what it did, just turned end over end and done everything. Bro- broke all the windows in the pilot house, took both doors out, smashed the dory on deck, split the dory in half, lengthways. The dory was in three pieces. The bottom was there where it was, and the two sides were that way. Just tore it in three pieces, endways, and there was, that was 4 o'clock in the morning. That lasted till 9 o'clock. Then it was flat calm. You know, all that time I was, you know, I had to do a lot of maneuvering to not do this again. So, and there was no storm on. It was undersea eruption. Must have been. Well, about last, last time Putney was up, he showed me, I went down, I had told him the story. He showed me where in 1969 or somewhere, some boat found right there about where this happened to me. So underwater mountain, you know, maybe a survey boat. You know, they're all the time sounding when you're traveling. 69, they found this. It was 66 feet, 11 fathoms underwater. And all around was 1,500 fathoms. So that's when this thing must have came up, and maybe it's going to come up again. See, that streak right there is very active from Atka volcano. See, there is on the Atka, there is a valley there. And, I saw three big geysers there one time, right by the beach, red hot waters squirting up in the air. And that was a water eruption, right down by the beach. And a week later I come back and it was, you know, it was over with. And I went up through that valley one time, and I'm trapping there. And all full of hot springs and real hot, and some little hot springs maybe only that big bubbling. Then there was several hot springs that they had a igloo over them, like a fair.
I guess the minerals of some kind,
the rock.
Rock.
Yeah. I suppose when it was real hot, this was a bubble, like, you know, and it hardened up there, and then there'd be a hole break in. Yeah, I think there was three of them. We looked in one of them, and it was just boiling hot water in there. But here was this perfectly round, and maybe about that thick. And it was rock, and these things were about 20 feet in diameter. And they were right in the middle of this flat. This was a lava flow originally. It was very flat, and here was the stream coming. Here was a hot stream here and a cold one here. They joined there and I went down to the beach.
Were you out to Boguslav?
I never have been ashore there.
I guess that's famous for going up and down in the last couple centuries.
Well, let's see, that was a new island after the Russians came. So I was reading. And let's see, 1999 or so. There was a mountain on it that just blew up. I think it was 1999 or 1998, somewhere in there. We had about an inch of dust here in the middle of the afternoon. Dark, you must stomach is acting up. That'll go away.
Do you want some water or something?
No. It, well, it got dark in the afternoon. We were in school yet. When it got dark, and there was this Bogoslav, this mountain, it was quite a big mountain. They called it Perry Peak.
Perry Peak, yeah.
Yeah, after a Coast Guard by the name of Perry.
Hmm.
That was one of them old Coast Guards, like the ones in the...
Yeah,
yeah, all them old Coast Guards those days were, you know, they had, they didn't use the sails, but they were rigged for sail. And they, see, I don't know how they call that, Perry Peak. Well, yeah, in this article about the McCulloch, there was a commanding officer by the name of Perry on that McCulloch.
Okay.
And anyhow, one of the Coast Guards was close there when this thing blew up, and when they had to run like mad to get away from there, that keep the, they couldn't shovel the ashes off the deck fast enough, they had to use a hose till they got a few miles away, you know. Yeah, and Perryville was named after Perry.
Oh, okay, after the Katmai, it was after the Katmai, they resettled that area.
Yeah. The refugees they took there, and why they picked that spot, I don't know, but they named it Perryville.
Yeah, yeah.
Either after the Coast Guard Perry or after this commander,
okay.
Perry. Yeah, let's see, that was 1912, I think.
The Katmai one.
Katmai,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to get a copy of that National Geographic book they've
mm-hmm.
put out quite a while ago, not too long after, I don't know, 1916 or 1920, they had some National Geographic expeditions into that area and,
mm-hmm.
and produced really a beautiful book on it.
Yeah. See, one book that National Geographic was, let's see, who was that woman here that she was going to send me a copy of it. She didn't.
Hmm. National Geographic?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was Ruth something.
How long ago?
Oh, it was several years ago that she was in the staff, National Geographic staff. And let's see, when, how the heck did you...
There was Fred Klein a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Now, this was a woman, though. Her name was Lucy something.
Hmm.
I saw her name in that geographic thing.
Yeah.
You know, in the front page.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She was in... well, there's different sections. There are different things that different people... Oh! Yeah, this Klein, I think, he'd been all over Alaska.
Yeah, I
taking
think so.
Pictures.
Yeah,
that's
right.
The same time.
Huh.
And, or I don't know if it was Klein, but some National Geographic guy was all over Alaska taking pictures, and they had all these in the copy there.
Hmm.
And she was with him, I think. And, anyhow, oh yeah, I mentioned right after the war, that Okmok Caldera
on Umneck.
On Umneck.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's 14 miles in diameter.
Man.
And there's three volcanoes inside.
Inside of it. Yeah, I
yeah.
heard that.
And they erupted.
Oh yeah? After the war?
After the war.
Mm.
And they were going to evacuate the airfield there.
Mm.
They didn't, but they were thinking of doing it. Anyhow, National Geographic sent their people up there, and they went up in the crater there and took pictures. See, one of these volcanoes, they were big,
yeah,
inside,
yeah,
this.
They must have been.
They were big as that one on Niger Point.
Okay. Yeah.
In the pictures,
mm-hmm,
and solid smoke coming out.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it wasn't just little.
Uh-huh.
And then the National Geographic came out with the half of that copy was that.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw one, I should have kept it. But she said she was going to send me a copy of that. But she
about
didn't.
Issue, huh?
Yeah. Of course, that was years, a lot,
yeah,
of years back.
Yeah.
But
that'd be interesting, though.
But then, yeah. Of course, I had a copy of it at the time it came out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
yeah,
I just threw it to one side, and
yeah,
that was it.
Yeah.
And later on, you wish you kept it.
Yeah. Did you ever meet Isabel Hutchinson? She was she wasn't really with the National Geographic, but she wrote a lot of articles for the National Geographic,
mm,
just at the time of the war. She,
yeah,
was a botanist from Scotland,
mm-hmm,
I think,
yeah,
Edinburgh, Scotland, and came out on, I don't remember what boat she came out on, collecting flowers, I guess. And she made one of the earliest ocean picture films,
oh, yeah,
showing parts of the Aleutians.
Mm-hmm.
She managed to film a little bit at Attu, I guess.
Yeah.
Back, and she had her films. I read her book, and in the back of her book, she said something about she had taken some cinematographic film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was up in Fairbanks, it was in 72. And so I wrote to the Edinburgh Museum. It's in the back of her book. She said she'd left all her stuff to the Edinburgh Museum.
Yeah.
So. Phil, come on in.
All right. You tell him I won't be here
tomorrow. No, he's going. Huh? He won't be here tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to Arizona.
You're going to where?
No, New Mexico.
Oh, New Mexico.
What you going to do in New Mexico?
Oh.
You're going to knock off some Mexicans?
I don't think they let them live anymore,
Henry.
Huh? No, it's has to do with Indian health, American Indian health.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't be here, and
we can go on to,
sure,
World War II.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Or,
yeah,
the island.
Yeah,
on,
yeah,
sure. Six o'clock, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wrote to the Edinburgh Museum, and asked if they had, what did I ask? I don't know if I asked if they had the film or if she was still alive or something. Anyway, they wrote,
yeah,
back and said she was still alive. She was 90-something, or I'm not sure,
yeah,
what all, but, and she had this film tucked away,
mm-hmm,
in her closet. And,
mm-hmm,
she sent it up to Fairbanks, and the university duplicated it and stuff.
Yeah.
They were supposed to put some of the footage in a film they were doing on basketball.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they ever finished it. I don't know. I've never seen it anyway. But she wrote a couple of interesting books.
Yeah.
We don't have them here, unfortunately. I've tried to get them. But Bridge to Russia?
No, I don't think so.
And this one is Bridge to Victory. They're both Howard Handelman, this one.
Yeah.
Aleutian war times. But like this one is 1943,
mm,
and I'm not sure what this one is. 47.
Yeah.
So they were written quite a bit before the Thousand Mile War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only mistake they made in the Thousand Mile War here that I know of was when when the Japs bombed, dropped the bomb in Alaska, they dropped it on the church.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not on the hospital.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know how that guy made that mistake.
I don't know, because all the photographs and stuff.
Yeah. Of course, he was, he researched that, you know, mm-hmm. and probably somebody that was here and told him that, that you know, didn't know
guy to see if he would send a
yeah, Casco was torpedoed there in Atka Harbor.
Hmm.
Seaplane tender.
Yeah.
Or that torpedo almost cut her in half.
Yeah.
But she floated. They towed her in here and they got that submarine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, there was a destroyer there that blew her out the water. Then the machine gun, the you know, they killed, there was three survivors. And they brought them to Alaska prisoners.
Oh yeah? Huh.
And they were marching them off the dock there. And they were blindfolded. And they, one of them was just a young kid, 14 years old,
wow.
So they say.
Uh-huh.
And the Marines were, you know, they had Marine guards all over.
Yeah.
And they were changing guards, you know, and how the Marines are in a very military manner, making a lot of racket.
Oh, yeah.
You know, working the officer, inspecting the rifle, and click, click, and the bolt, and all this and that. And this Japanese kid thought that they were a firing squad.
Oh.
And he fell on the ground, started to cry.
Mm-hmm.
The two Japs, they stood there, you know, they were going to die for the emperor and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But that kid didn't want to die for no emperor. He wanted to live.
Yeah.